Okay, House Judiciary is called to order. We're ordering as we speak. It is 1:15 and it is March the 9th. Present for the record, we have Representatives Gruenberg, Cott, Guerra, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. And I just want to say a special thank you to my committee members that are here with me today for making my quorum and allowing us to move forward on the business we have. I know a lot of folks are gone, and you made special provisions to be here, so thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Gruenberg.
Anybody else here?
Hockhill
and Dahlstrom, how about Anderson? Is he coming?
Yes, Anderson will be here.
Because I may have to absent myself at some point. But I won't if we need
to. He should be here shortly. So Representative Dahlstrom and Coghill are excused, and Representative Anderson will be here.
I won't have you drop below a quorum.
Okay. Fantastic. Okay, my understanding is the meth bill is ready to go.
We're awaiting a CS.
Okay. So instead, is Mike Kelly here? Representative Kelly? Oh, we've got Keith is here. Fantastic. Okay, so let's House Bill 103, Claims Against the State. Keith Hilliard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Keith Hilliard. I'm staff to Representative Mike Kelly. Representative Kelly apologized for not being here, but travel arrangements preclude him from being here. I'm here to present to you HB 103, Actionable Claims Against the State. A very short bill, as you can see, I believe a total of three lines. This bill does a simple change to existing procedure by which claims against the state are adjudicated, and that will be, we will be moving from a jury trial to a trial by court, and this is pursuant, this is essentially a return back to original statute pre-1975. As my sponsor statement alludes, or actually states specifically, in 1975, the University of Alaska was party to a suit in which it petitioned the court for a jury trial. I don't have the background to understand exactly what their motivation was in that particular case. I have provided the case for the committee members. It's National Aircraft Leasing versus University of Alaska. Nonetheless, Senator John Butrovich from Fairbanks at that time sponsored that bill to make that change. I have had the opportunity to speak with a member of the Board of Regents from the 1975 period who indeed confirmed for me that Senator Butrovich did it expressly for that purpose to make that change for the university. Had no effect because the case was settled prior to the passage of the legislation. Representative Kelly and I have spoken with University General Counsel since they seem to be the original cause of the change. The current General Counsel has no problem with this change. In addition, we've also been in contact with the Alaska Trial Lawyers Association. At this point in time, they essentially remain neutral. So with that, I will be happy to answer questions, and I also have in the audience Mr. Doug Wolliver from the Alaska Court System, who's here to answer questions, and online is Gail Voigtlander from the Department of Law.
That is correct. Doug, did you want to just answer questions? Do you want to make a statement on the record? Okay. And Gail Voigtlander, just to answer questions, any statement on the record from Department of Law?
Just to answer questions, Madam Chairman.
Okay. Anybody else here in the audience to testify on House Bill number 103, Claims Against the State? Anybody else online that I don't have? Okay, so hearing none, that closes public testimony, and brings the bill back before us for committee discussion. Questions? Discussion?
Sure.
Representative Kira.
This is a pretty big bill, certainly the first I saw of it, I know it's been pending, but the first I saw of it was prior to this meeting. I have a lot of concerns, and I suppose it's big enough that I'd like the other members of the committee to be here so they can discuss it as well. And I think I'd like to have a sort of full, drawn-out discussion of it with all the committee members present.
My intent, Representative Guerra, at the request of other members who are not here and some that are here, to hold it over until our Wednesday meeting and bring it up at the top of the hour. It's already noticed for the top bill. The only point that I would make is simply that if there are things that to flesh out with the bill's sponsor that you'd like him to consider or look into, now would be the time to start that ball rolling. Because on the day that it's brought up, we'll also have a continuation of Amrata Hess, and we'll have House Bill 188 regarding state of Alaska capital bonds. So it'll, in an overview by Department of Corrections, so it'll be a pretty tough day. So my thought was we could bring it up and start the discussion. Representative Gruenberg.
We had quite a discussion about this in state affairs, and I voted a do not pass on it. I have some very serious concerns, which I stated on the record, about it. And I would like the chair's permission, if I do have a witness or something, to be able to have some public testimony.
Sure. I can,
let me tell you. I note that Bart Rozelle from Juneau was one of counsel, the counsel in this case. I was practicing when this was originally passed. It's actually, I think that if the truth be known, the juries tend to favor defendants, do they not? That's my experience. And in this case, as we discussed in state affairs, the University of Alaska, who was the defendant below, had asked for the jury. That was just a case in point. And which would explain where people are on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. Since I've been past the gavel, Les, can you just share with me some of maybe just your basic concerns with the bill?
Yeah.
Not to go into any great detail, but just so it gives us a little food for thought over the week.
I guess I can share this perspective from somebody who practiced law. I mean, I always felt if you had a good case, you would want the judge or jury to get it right. And there's more chance of a jury getting it right than there is of a judge getting it right. What happens in the dynamic of a jury trial is that certain people miss certain evidence. And they all get in the room, and then one will say, do you remember this part? And then another will say, do you remember this part? And I think when you put 12 heads together, or six heads, I think, is a district court case, but when you put 12 heads together, you have more of a chance of getting it exactly right than you do if you're one person. So I think jury trials are better than judge trials. That's my personal belief. I think the constitutional framework is that people get to be judged by their peers, and I think the value of the jury system is incredible in my view. And so I don't like taking away the right of the community to come in and judge the conduct of the state, judge the conduct of the plaintiff. I would be more scared as a litigant of a decision by a judge than I would a decision by a jury. So I think the jury process is much stronger than letting just a judge decide a case. It's also faster. What happens is judges, when they decide cases, like any sort of person who's overwhelmed with work, they'll sit on a case during the trial, and they feel compelled to write a written decision, and it can be 6 months or longer to get a decision out of a judge after the trial is over. A jury returns the verdict pretty quickly, and I think those are, you know, some of those are prejudices, some of those are probably more rationally thought out positions than others, but I like the jury system.
Max.
Yeah, I as a family lawyer, haven't tried all that many cases to a jury. I have tried some. With a jury verdict, unless there's something very unusual or the evidence could not possibly support the factual decision of a jury, or the jury instructions are erroneous, which doesn't happen very often now because we have pattern jury instructions, it's very hard to overturn a jury verdict. On the other hand, judges enter factual findings and conclusions of law, and deference is given to them, but you can pick on appeal the judge's decision apart much more easily than you can a jury. So much easier to overturn, not much, but it is easier to overturn a judge's decision than a jury's for that reason.
Okay, as Madam Chair indicated, we will hold this bill over and give us some opportunity to give us some further personal consideration.
Think about it.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cobb. Take that.
Just one other thing, and this applies to, we get this in many, many, when many, many bills come before us. I don't find it useful to hear one side of the story and make a decision based on one side of the story. There's a page in here that has four cases that were filed against the state, and it has the state's rendition of what happened in these cases. I can't make a decision as to whether or not these cases were fairly decided, not fairly decided, unless I also hear the other side of the story. So I'm unless I hear from both sides of the story, I'm not going to rely on this document that has the state's version of whether or not four cases filed against the state were properly decided, damages were too high, too low. It would be useful for me to hear from both sides before I relied on a document like this. The practical limitation is we're not going to conduct four trials on these cases. But it's just my way of pointing out that anecdotal information from one side in a hotly litigated case is often not that useful.
Yep, and as you know, too, Representative Guerra, often it's usually not the bill sponsor that will bring forward the critical analysis of their own bill. So so for those watching or anybody who's interested, and then we've got a week of individual study as lawmakers to see what else we can come up with in terms of the other side of the story. If there is one. And so with that, thank you, and we'll bring it back up first thing on Wednesday. And I might suggest that you drop a note to Representative Dahlstrom and Coghill, let them know that too, so they can get ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have done that.
Okay.
Thank you.
One question, Madam Chair, actually for
one
the
more.
Bill's
Representative Kerr.
Yes, sir.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
You miss us?
I do, actually.
I sort of think he does.
I think he does, too.
I think I know the answer to this, because obviously the Constitution doesn't require a jury trial in civil cases against the state, but it does in civil cases against private individuals. How does this bill relate to what the Constitution says?
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative Guerra. I believe it's Article 1, Section 16 of the state Constitution provides that there will be a jury trial in civil matters pertaining to private citizens amongst themselves, and Article 2, Section 21 of the state Constitution provides that the legislature will have the discretion to make the determination about how actionable claims against the state will be handled.
Thank you. Thanks, Heath. Okay. Do we have our meth? Okay, no meth.
Still waiting.
Okay. So, without further ado, House Bill 187, Amaretta Hessen, come. And I don't know, is there somebody from the governor's presenting it?
I brought the things by.
Okay. Is there somebody presenting it, or?
Let's see. Devin Mitchell and Brad Pierce.
Okay. So, Devin Mitchell and Brad Pierce, do you want to come up together, or one of you?
Devin Mitchell, I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'm the state's debt manager. I believe Brad went to go get Cheryl Frasca, so she's been introducing the bill to committees.
Okay.
So if you wanted to wait until she came back, she came down, or...
Okay. We'll do that. We'll take a brief at ease. One 30 here, and we have the lovely Cheryl Frasca.
Boy, this is a lot different than finance committees.
Yes, it's much more receptive. So welcome to House Judiciary, and tell us about House Bill 187.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is the infrastructure for our Amaretta Hess proposal by which the governor's budget would fund about $340 million worth of capital projects. And we're going to have a team approach to laying out the bill for you today, if that's okay. We have Mike Barnhill, who's here from the Department of Law, who can speak to sort of the history of the settlement and how we got to where we are today. And then we have the Department of Revenue to speak to the provisions as they're laid out in the two pieces of legislation and the kind of structure that was necessary for the proposal on how to issue the bonds and then use the earnings from the Amerada Hess settlement to pay for the debt. So if that's okay, I'm just here
just
as
fine.
The just another pretty face.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, Mike Barhill, do you want to proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Barnhill, Assistant Attorney General with the Commercial Section of the Department of Law. I don't know how much detail you want on the Amerada Hess litigation. I'm sure most everybody knows the state filed suit against the oil companies in 1977. The litigation proceeded for many, many years. When it was on its way to trial in the late 80s, objections were raised to Alaska judges and Alaska jurors sitting on the case for reasons of bias because they could potentially benefit from any judgment achieved in the case because a portion of it would go into the permanent fund and earnings from that portion that went into the permanent fund would flow to permanent fund dividends. This issue was litigated in multiple courts before multiple judges. Eventually it culminated in some legislation that was enacted in Title 37 in the Permanent Fund Statute that provided that any monies that came from the Amerada Hess litigation into the Permanent Fund would be segregated and any earnings on those monies would not flow into the Permanent Fund dividends. The earnings would be rededicated back to the principal of the Permanent Fund. And so that's where we are today. The issue has been raised whether we can change that statute, and there's differing views legally. It's the Department of Law's view that you can change that statute. There are policy implications that are inherent in doing so. The attorneys that worked in the litigation, the Amerada Hess litigation, are concerned about perceptions of repealing the statute in the future if there's a big case that could potentially benefit the permanent fund. And we solve the same bias issue by segregating whatever monies flow into the permanent fund. And then, you know, if the state gets the reputation of just enacting these statutes and then repealing them, there's concern about the perception that creates. But that's a policy issue, not a legal issue. I don't know how much more detail you folks would like on the Amerada Hess history or the statute.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. Mr. Barnhill, what's the chapter and year of the Amerada Hess Act?
What's the chapter and the year? The statute's in Title 37. I believe it was enacted in 1989.
I would appreciate it if, say, by 4 o'clock today, you could get me the site on the chapter and the year so I can. I'm going to get on a plane and I'd like to take it with me.
Oh, okay, sure. No
I need a site on that. If you could just call my office on that. Number two, through the chair, you said the Department of Law says you can change the statute. I haven't reviewed. Do we have a copy of the legal opinion from law in here?
Yes, and I believe in your packet there's a memo from Wilson Condon that addresses
Will
it.
Wilson Condon has one.
Yeah.
Okay, and now you said that law says you can. Do you have legal opinions that say you can't?
No.
Who says you can't?
We don't have legal opinions that say you can't.
So I can, I don't know if you were here when Representative Guerra or somebody was, maybe it was the chair, was talking about the other side of the mountain. But who has said you can't? I mean, what knowledgeable lawyer, not somebody else?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I understand. If you're asking, has the Department of Law opined that we cannot change the statute?
No.
The Department of Law has not opined that.
I thought you said that the Department of Law has opined that you can change the
right.
statute. Okay. My question is, has anybody taken the opposite position?
Within the Department of Law, no.
About outside the Department of Law?
I have no idea, through the chair.
I don't think that
that the issue is whether the change in the statute was permissive. Obviously, the legislature has the prerogative to change the statute, but I think what Mr. Barnhill was saying was that the spirit of the agreement is incorporated into the statute. And so, prospectively, how does that impact our negotiations in the future? And I think that's
I see. Was that what you were saying?
Through the chair, there was never any agreement to do this. This was just a solution that the state came up with to solve the concern about potential bias of judges and jurors. And I should say as well that the court system also came up with its own solution. And in 1989, it amended both the civil and criminal rules to provide that the mere receipt of a permanent fund dividend would not constitute a challenge for cause. And that went into the civil rules in 1990 and into the criminal rules in 1990. So really thereafter, I mean, that's the Alaska Supreme Court saying, we don't think that the mere receipt of a permanent fund dividend should create sufficient bias to excuse a juror.
You have a side on that.
Yeah, I do, through the chair.
I do recall that now.
It was Supreme Court Order 1013, dated October 12, 1989, and it went into effect January 15, 1990, amending Civil Rule 47C12 and Criminal Rule 24C12. And since then, there's been a new provision put into Rule 47, so you'll find that provision now at Civil Rule 47C13.
Okay.
And through the chair, I dug out my information. The site that you're asking for is AS 3713-145D.
3713-145D. Yeah, that has to do with the jury trial, right?
No, that has to do with the segregation of the Amarada Hess money within
the chair. There is something in there about the jury trial as well that's no longer effective. I put in a bill last year to repeal that because it was out of date, so that'll get me into where I want to go. The final question, Madam Chair, that I have is, and we were talking earlier, and I had forgotten that the Supreme Court had promulgated those rules, but that only relates to the issue of the permanent fund as a disqualifier. That seems to me to be one application, and Mr. Woolover and I were talking earlier about what's called the doctrine of necessity, the rule of necessity, which is that if everybody's disqualified, nobody's disqualified. Court systems have used it, for example, if challenges to the federal judicial retirement system, where every federal judge in the country be disqualified, and there are cases that saying because you have to have somebody to try the case that nobody's disqualified. And I was wondering if the Department of Law has any feeling about having a statute that would statutorily enact the rule of necessity.
Through the chair, I don't have any opinion to express on that at this time. No.
Sorry, I didn't mean to blindside you. I did, but I didn't expect an answer. Thanks. No, nothing personal. I appreciate the answer.
Anything further that you want to add? Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, I've got a few questions on this, quite a few. Just tell me if somebody else wants to chime in, just let me know. Mr. Barnhill, let me just let you know where I'm coming from in the first place. I think it would be a travesty for this state to make its policy based upon what I consider to be a frivolous argument made by oil company attorneys 15 years ago. So the Supreme Court has already ruled essentially by adopting a civil rule that it's okay for somebody to sit on a jury even though they get a dividend. What were the court rulings as this case was being litigated on that issue? When the oil company attorneys came in and said, God, we can't go to trial, we should delay this trial and maybe have a trial out of state because we can't trust Alaska jurors on a case like this, what were the court rulings?
Through the chair, there were several court rulings. And I can give you a list if you'd like. I can try and step through them. I've got some discussion here.
I need you to go through each of them. Is it as easy to say they came down on one side or the other side, or were they mixed on the issue?
I think the ones that came down were in favor of not disqualifying the judge.
If you find out that there were any favoring the oil company argument, just let me know. But
I'd have to check, but I don't believe there were, through the chair.
So So right now we're faced with this policy choice. The only reason we've exempted, we've said that this income doesn't go into the permanent fund dividend, is because we did that to terminate the sort of litigation over this issue before the Amaretta Hess case. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, the reason this was done was just to solve what was perceived at that time as a problem with the case going forward.
I'm going to limit my questions to you to sort of legal questions, and I don't think I have any more. I mean, I certainly have real policy concerns, but I don't think they're fairly directed at Mr. Barnhill.
If I could just follow up on one. You asked if there were any decisions favoring the oil companies, and I said there wasn't. Judge Carpinetti did issue a notice that he intended to issue such a decision, but he never did. And it was in the wake of that this legislation was enacted. So technically speaking, I don't believe there was any decision favoring the oil companies, but there could have been had the legislation not been enacted.
And Judge Carpinetti had issued a sort of tentative, I'm going to rule one way or the other.
It was called a notice of intention to grant motion for disqualification.
So Judge Carpinetti was going to do it then?
Well, he said he was going to do it.
Okay.
Any further questions for Mr. Barnhill? Representative Gruenberg.
We've been given a copy of Exxon Corp v. Court of Appeals for the Ninth, versus Hines. That's one we have here, just for the record. Is that the main one, to your knowledge? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. Is that the one from 92, Judge Holland confirming or affirming Judge Singleton's decision not to recuse himself?
No, this is prior to that. This vacated and remanded a decision by Singleton to dismiss the complaint with prejudice. And it remanded it to dismiss the complaint without prejudice.
Through the chair, what's the site on that?
32 F. 3rd, 1399.
Okay.
November 1993.
Right.
I'm sorry. That was when it was argued. It was decided in August '94.
Through the chair, that particular decision does not address the bias issue. It says, and I can quote from it, because the parties have not yet developed a factual record on the value of the remaining claims or their potential impact, if any, on the Alaska Permanent Fund dividends, we cannot evaluate Exxon's bias claims on their merits. So that's not one of the decisions. They just punted, basically.
Madam Chair, through the chair, I would like these sites on the
sure.
cases.
Yeah, and Vanessa has the one that Mr. Barnhill was just referring to, but he said we express no opinion on the merits of the party's argument regarding abstention and the rule of necessity of the district court or dismissing Exxon's complaint was prejudice and vacated. So that Vanessa has this one.
Yes, it too.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Barnhill? Representative Guerra?
Thanks, Mr. Barnhill. How much ultimately did we receive over the years in the Amaretta Hess case litigation?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, there are individuals from Office of Management Budget that can answer that. I believe the total amount was somewhere north of $250 million, and then with interest compounding over the years, it's worth something north of $400 million today. But I don't have the specific number. Devin's nodding, so I guess I got close.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Mitchell, you want to testify?
So again, I'm Devin Mitchell. I'm the debt manager for the state of Alaska in the Department of Revenue. In your packet, there's some information that we can refer to. I'm not sure how much detail you want on the proposal in the two bills, but the general ideas flow in concert. The first bill, 187, would allow a change in the flow of earnings from the Amerita Hess settlement, where the current statute has those earnings flowing back into the principal, and instead we would have the earnings flow out to a new account called the Alaska Capital Income Account. The second bill creates the State of Alaska the State of Alaska Capital Corporation, which would have the ability to issue up to $350 million in obligations of the corporation that would be used to fund capital projects in the state. And the potential source of payment of operating leases that the corporation would enter into with agencies that would benefit from these projects would be the Alaska Capital Income Account. Initially, the Alaska Capital Income Account would also be used to fund the corporation, so provide the corporation its beginning fund balance to allow operations to commence. The goal of this structure was to allow us to move forward and leverage this fund and achieve this project list in a manner that would allow tax-exempt bonds to be used as the funding source while maintaining the ability to invest money in a taxable fashion. The bond structure that would be implemented would be a combination of security features and flexibility features to allow us to adjust annual payments. Initially, we were talking about a structure which would have a 40-year interest-only structure with a final maturity that would have a bullet or a balloon payment, and we'd have the flexibility in the interim years to retire debt as receipts of the corporation might exceed the nominal interest payment amounts. The one key security feature that is implemented into the corporation is the moral obligation pledge of the state on a debt service reserve fund. So that's the basic overview. If you look in your packet, there's a couple of flowcharts on page 7 and 8 that actually help visualize what I'm talking about. So the first one on page 7 is for the Alaska Capital Income Account. You can see the permanent fund and the Amerita Hess portion being represented in the flowchart that's on the top, and the earnings flowing around from the Amerita Hess back into it. Realized earnings going over to the earnings reserve, realized earnings of the permanent fund going over to the earnings reserve and being funded out in dividends per the formula. The proposal that's found on the bottom, the only change is that Amerita Hess, instead of circling earnings around to itself, would provide earnings to the Alaska Capital Income Account that would be available for appropriation by the legislature. On page 8, you have the corporation structure. The bill would provide for the corporation to have a revenue fund, which would receive annual appropriation. It would have the ability to create a debt service reserve fund, which could be funded from receipts of the revenue fund, receipts of the corporation. The ability to create a bond redemption fund, which again would flow from the revenue fund and fund operations. The middle of the flow chart has a corporate bond issue, which would be the State of Alaska Capital Corporation bond issue, which it is envisioned to have flexible amortization, as I described earlier. The bonds would fund up the construction fund, the proceeds of that bond sale, which would be used for the projects that are identified in the legislation through the normal spending process the state uses for other capital projects. The investors would be repaid from the cycling of money through the bond redemption fund. A couple of security features, as I already described, we'd have a debt service reserve fund, which would be funded up, and a bond redemption fund, which would be funded in advance of actual amortization requirements, and so we'd be funded essentially a year in advance on our bond redemption fund as well to account for the potential for lower appropriations years. The following page, on page 9, there's some spreadsheets, 9, 10, 11, and 12, which actually show some modeling of how this might work with some assumptions that are currently being used. We have on page 9 the Alaska Capital Income Account, which would be invested in a like manner to other investments of the Permanent Fund Corporation with the same asset allocation it currently has, would continue to have that. The anticipated realized return or realized earnings rate is 7.04, which is differentiated from the total return expectation of 7.61 for the corporation. But at 7.04%, you have an annual transfer of $29.9 million with rounding. If you look over on page 10, this is the corporation, and this is showing the annual lease appropriation received that's equivalent to the earnings rate that's shown on the prior page in the fifth column over, lease appropriation received. It has a borrowing rate of 6%, which we believe to be high at this point. It has a reinvestment rate of corporate assets of 2% because we'd have a much shorter time horizon with these assets, and they would be invested in more liquid fashion. Again, this is a conservative rate with what's currently happening in the markets in short-term interest rates. The outstanding bond column, it might help to flip over to page 12. We're looking at a net funding of our project list, and so we generated our cash flow and anticipated a reinvestment of proceeds during the life of the bond of the construction fund at 3%, which would net $343 million in capital projects out of $326 million in proceeds, which are reflected on page 10 in the outstanding bond column beginning in 2006. That amount then has nominal interest payments associated with it, which are derived from the 6% borrowing rate. We have contributions of earnings on fund balance that go into the calculation. Transfers out, the transfer out in 2006 would be to fund up the debt service reserve account or the debt service reserve fund and then an ending balance column. And if you look down, you can see the flexible nature where in 2008 we began paying on principal with the $21 million figure shown in 2008, and that begins diminishing the outstanding bond amount and diminishing the nominal payment requirement. And that's the basic explanation of how this is envisioned. We do anticipate further refinement of leveraging security and structure as we move along. And if, as we move, we would continue to explore structuring possibilities, including variable rate debt, the use of swaps possibly to and all of these would be used, by the way, to ensure the highest probability that debt service would be paid from receipts of the corporation rather than from any other funding source, which that's the highest priority for all of these structural ideas. And if there were any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So let's take this in two separate stages. The first part is the earnings from the Amerita Hess part of the permanent fund that you propose to spend, and then the other part is the amount that you propose to bond. So my understanding is just in sheer earnings, the proposal is to set free about $30 million a year of permanent fund earnings that are just going to be put into the general fund. Is that part correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the structure would allow for the earnings of the Amerita Hess rather than to become principal to flow over to the earnings reserve, and so it would not go to the general fund but rather to the earnings reserve.
Yes. It would be available for appropriation.
Reserve called the Alaska Capital Income Account. That's right, available for appropriation.
And that's the estimates are, that's about $30 million a year?
That's the estimate.
And then explain to me the bonding part of the proposal is that there's a proposal to issue bonds based upon the value of the whole Amerita Hess part of the permanent fund. Is that correct?
Sure. It's not there. The idea to leverage is not necessarily linked specifically to any. It wouldn't be linked to a pledge of principal that resides in that we're calling the Amerita Hess settlement. It would be a leveraging of a public corporation of the state of Alaska supported by operating leases that public corporation would enter into that could be paid from earnings of this settlement that would flow through the Alaska Capital Income Account. And that's quite an important feature of the potential leveraging, because you can't have a pot of money that you pledge to a leveraging and issue those bonds on a tax-exempt basis, as that's not allowed under the tax code of the United States.
Just to understand, and I don't think I do, just to understand, so are we pledging part of the permanent fund to support these bonds in any way? So what's being pledged to support these bonds then?
Through the chair, the corporation's revenues would be pledged, and those revenues would be derived through operating leases of the corporation. And the credit that folks would look at when they were analyzing this, on its face, that would be considered a less creditworthy pledge than the state might otherwise provide through other financing vehicles. But by implementing a moral obligation on the debt service reserve fund, even though we don't intend to rely on that as a funding source, as a means of repayment, it creates a backstop or a minimum credit threshold for our leveraging, which we would anticipate to be in the A ratings category.
So maybe I can understand it better this way. Assuming that the bonds are issued and we default on our bond obligations, the bond issuer would have a right to then take something from us because we've defaulted. What is it that they would have the right to attach at that point if we defaulted?
Through the chair, they would not have the right to attach anything other than the revenues of this corporation. There would be a requirement in this statute. There's a requirement in the statute that the corporation would request, in the event of a failure of ability to pay debt service, which we don't anticipate, of course, that there be a replenishment. The corporation would request the legislature to replenish the reserve fund from other funding sources. That is what constitutes a moral obligation. And there isn't a requirement that it be replenished. It would be a situation where there would be potential for other negative credit action if there were a failure to replenish that reserve. There is other moral obligation debt of the state of Alaska, the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, the Student Loan Corporation, and HFC all have the ability to issue moral obligation debt. Not that the HFC doesn't have any moral obligation debt outstanding right now, but the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, all of their bonds are moral obligation. The student loan bonds are moral obligations of the state. There's other funds, the DEC Clean Water and Drinking Water Funds, if they were leveraged, they would also have the moral obligation of the state.
Chair, I don't want to slow the members of the committee down. I certainly understand the governor's proposal to use the Amerita Hess portion of permanent fund earnings to fund the capital projects. I have still have a lot of questions about the bonding portion of this that I frankly don't understand at this point. I could ask more questions, but I don't want to hold other people back.
I see co-sponsorship in those eyes.
you're having a visual problem that is of mammoth proportions right now.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, thank you. So, in essence, we've completed 187 and 188 together. So, we'll bring them back up again next week, and we'll have the full committee here at that time. So, you have the ability to reach out to these guys and fill them in on what you just did today, so we don't start over from ground zero. That'd be great. Thank you very much. So we do have the CS, or the Mega Methamphetamine and Precursors Bill. Boy, we just cleared out the whole room. Representative Ram Ross, present that to us. And I want to say thank you to you and your staff, Jane, and to Vanessa Tondini and Department of Law. Dean Guinelli for taking the last 48 hours and working really hard on a CS.
Madam Chair, Jay Ramirez, I too wanted to thank Jerry Luckup, who has gotten a little sleep over the last couple of days trying to accommodate us. And Dean and I had a great conversation. He's been super accommodating to work with Ms. Tendini and Jane Pearson. We're really very grateful.
Thank you, Dean.
Does everyone have the CS and the explanation of the needs?
Okay, you guys, do you want to walk us through it?
Yeah. Yes, my name is Jane Pearson, and through the chair, on page 3, line 7. You're going to have to bear with me here because my pages aren't exactly correct, not having this in front of me. Class A felony was changed to a B felony to keep it somewhat consistent. On page 5, line 3.
You might want to clarify, this was written in response.
Yeah, this was written previous to seeing this. So if my lines are a little off, I've kind of gone through and tried to keep it on point. But on page 5, line 3, we've lessened the mens rea from knowing to reckless. And the same follows on lines 7 and 8. On page 5, lines 5 through 18, 9 grams has been replaced with 6 grams for consistency for possession.
Where's that?
That's,
oh, I see.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That is
17.
On page 5, lines 24 for 30, the terms for a person who possessed the listed chemicals are changed to be consistent with the definitions on pages 8 and 10. And terms for iodine distributor are also added on page 6, line 8. On page 6, line 3, let's see if I'm still on here. No, page 6, line 18. There's a structural change. It was affected by adding. On page 8, there's one thing in there that wasn't done, so we'll just skip that and cross that out. Page 7, line 31. But on page 8, line 28, there's a change for consistency in the terms of retail distributors, manufacturers, and manufacturers. On page 8, line 17, it removes, was on the old one, because now it's removed, removes pediatric gel and liquid forms of pseudoephedrine from the list of exceptions. Since liquid pseudoephedrine can be extracted from, or pseudoephedrine can be extracted from gel and liquid products, and meth manufacturers, especially in Alaska, where we don't have a lot of other states, may turn to gel or liquid products if pseudoephedrine in tablet form becomes more difficult to acquire in any quantity. We've removed the registration with Department of Public Safety for manufacturers, wholesalers, and retail sellers of pseudoephedrine, since there are already federal regulations under 21 U.S.C. 821 that they already have to register. On page 9, lines 17 to 23, let's see if I'm still on point. Products containing ephedrine and phenylpropanolamine are added to pseudoephedrine, and required identification is changed to valid government-issued photographic identification. And that is on page 10, line 4 for the identification. There is also a change that the logbook should include the type of government identification and the identification number on the card. Mm-hmm. We also, on page 10, included iodine and iodine crystal to be kept behind the counter. That's not a change that was made. That would be it.
Okay. Thank you for the detail of the changes in the CS, which is before us. Representative Ramos, do you have any more points to add? And then we'll go to questions from the committee.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Mr. Vice Chair.
We have. Representative Grunberg.
Jane, looking at the page 9, line 29, to page 10, line 14.
I'm sorry, would you make the reference again, please?
Yeah, it's on the second page of your notes here. I don't see definitions for dispenser or retail distributor.
No, we ended up not using those because we changed the wording.
Those are out. Does it define readily? Is there now a redefinition of readily retrievable?
Yes.
So that's it.
It says outside the state, readily retrievable records must be furnished within 3 days, working days, by courier, facsimile, mail, or electronic mail.
Now,
it wasn't, I believe that was the same.
I also don't see your final thing, tagline, on the civil penalty. Is that?
No, we didn't include that.
So that's out too.
It's a little hard to do this before I'd seen the CS.
No, that's perfectly okay. I just want to be sure that I at least know what we're talking about. Having something through the chair, having this is extremely helpful. And I'd like to focus on a couple of things here. Mm-hmm. That my staff, I think, talked to you about. House Bill 99 made this a Class C felony. Your original bill made it a Class A felony. Now we've got it a Class B felony. It sounds like hopscotch here. I'd like to go into the policy reasons why we went all the way from a Class C with the governor's bill to a Class A in your bill, and now to a Class B. I need to be convinced we need to be above a Class C. That's one issue I want to flag for you. Secondly, I want to flag for you your changes on page 5, lines 3 and 4.
Yes,
please. Yeah, from a knowing to reckless, and on 5, lines 7 to 8. If you would give me your thoughts and reasons for those changes, please, one of you, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think it should be a Class A because I think that's an emotional response to what a horrible thing I think it is to expose children to the toxic materials and the toxic behavior when you're cooking meth in a confined space and you're keeping children there. I don't think it's supportable by law, you know, as other child endangerment laws prescribe a lesser sentence, but I personally just think they all should be Class A penalties, but we could take that up in another bill on another day. So I think you're right that it's hopscotch, and I'd like to take responsibility for that, to have a kind of an emotional reaction to that, and I'm open to attorneys, you know, that would better understand that than a layperson just looking at this as the most heinous thing that you can expose a child to. And then with regard to your concern over the word reckless rather than knowing, these are legal terms, and I believe that reckless is a lesser term, but I'd rather defer to Jane on our rationale for that.
That was also something, Jane through the chair. This is something we also discussed with Department of Law. And this is a change that they thought would be good news.
I assume, because maybe we need to have Mr. Guanelli up here for this, but if possibly, I don't know how you plan to handle that. I would like to ask him
sure. On
that issue. Maybe he could join everybody up here. I'd like to ask him the question
sure. On
the recklessness thing.
Mr. Guanelli, thank you for joining us. So the question is regarding reckless
Reluctant to take the center chair, but...
Yes, you're boxed in.
Season party. Be here.
A rose between two thorns.
Amen.
And maybe I could just ask, is this because of a proof problem?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Grunberg, that's what it is. What we are finding, what troopers are finding, is that meth users are often trading the raw materials, the precursors, the pseudoephedrine, the phosphorus, the iodine, for the finished product. And when that occurs, if we had to prove that they knew that the other person was going to manufacture that, we believe that would be difficult to do. They would say, well, I didn't know he was going to manufacture. I thought maybe he was going to trade it for something else, or maybe he was going to do something. But yet, showing the reckless element where they're consciously aware of a risk and they disregard the risks that it's a classic methamphetamine ingredient, I think is more appropriate to what's actually going on the streets and the kind of proof problems we would have before a jury.
If I may.
Yeah, Representative
Kroon. I understand what you're saying. Is misconduct in the second degree, what class felony is that?
I believe that is a Class A felony.
Yeah, I see on page 4, line 10 and 11, that has with the intent to manufacture or deliver. Why should you have a lower mental intent mens rea here than in that?
Through the chair, the specific provision I think that you're looking at talks about manufacturing or delivering any amount of a Schedule 1A controlled substance. That is that's heroin and other opium-based products. And the manufacturers with intent to manufacture delivers or possesses with intent.
And the same on line 20, of course.
Right.
Which is very similar. I mean, it seems to me, and I've got problems in increasing, we seem to be increasing a lot of crimes across the board in this legislature. I'm, as you know, no bleeding heart kind of guy, but I've got real problems when we just go wholesale here. And I would say we should be consistent across the board.
Let me see if I can. Let's take a look at line 20, first of all. That is a that's a possessory offense. So we find someone in possession of that, and a reckless mental state when you have, saying that someone possesses it with reckless disregard that they are going to manufacture it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, if you possess something,
sure,
and we are
I
going
agree.
To make possession
that makes
of
sense.
It. Okay, with lines 10 and 11, I think it is simply a matter of reflecting the current state of street level activity, and at the time that statute was enacted, heroin production and delivery. I think the legislature felt, and probably with our advice, that intent to deliver was adequate in terms of proof. I think the kinds of people you're dealing with who have the precursors, have the ingredients, the troopers are often finding that they're dealing with addicts who are actually, addicted users who are actually going out, getting these materials. And trying to prove a specific intent mental state with the kind of addicted people that they're dealing with on the street level, we thought was imposed too big a burden. Maybe we ought to change the reckless on on lines 10 and 11. But I think what's before us now is the specific problem with methamphetamine, the specific activity that is being seen, and we just believe that reckless is a more appropriate mental state.
Are you are now, through the chair, are you now charging these people with any kind of a crime?
Um,
if they, there are some crimes related to listed chemicals, and I'd have to actually.
Well, my question is there in fact a proof problem now? And I would ask, is there a proof problem for the heroin type? Because I have many years ago, in my younger, more reckless days, intentional days, I'd say, reckless, I did a little bit of criminal law. I know these people are kind of zoned out regardless of what they're on. It's hard to find out where their mind is anyway. I'm wondering, traditionally, it's very similar. It's just the drug of choice has changed. I'm wondering, have there been serious proof problems and inability to convict under subsection 1? I'm not aware if there have.
Through the chair, actually, Representative Groomberg, let me just, you know, the more I'm looking at this, I believe that lines 10 and 11 possess any amount of heroin or opium products with intent to manufacture or deliver. I think the with intent to manufacture or deliver modifies possessory offense, the verb possesses. So I think the same comments I had about lines 20 and 21 really apply to lines 10 and 11.
I see what you're saying. Well, then you're saying,
I think it's the possessory offense, possession with intent to.
I think you're right.
To manufacture, okay. Deliver. But even so, I think that the situation is that we don't have a lot of manufacturing of opium products in Alaska. Those mostly come, you know, fully formed from outside of Alaska, and you may have a possession with intent to deliver. I think we rarely find possession with intent to manufacture, just because of the nature of the of the activity.
May I ask another question? I'm going to get back to you on the Class B versus Class C in a minute, but skipping ahead to page 5, lines 17, going down from 9 to 6 grams. What was the reason for that, Mr. Guinelli?
Through the chair, this was a recommendation from the Alaska State Troopers, who wanted provide consistent amounts that that they could deal with in terms of instructing their own officers, instructing other police officers around the state, and just in terms of notice to the public and to the retailers. But I think that the level of 6 grams is that level 6, 7, 8, 9 grams is the kind of typical amount of pseudoephedrine that is being found in many of the meth labs in Alaska.
How big a quantity is that?
It's roughly a quarter of an ounce. It's not a lot of it. It's probably. I think they say a gram is roughly a raisin. So you're looking you're looking at a small, handful of raisins. The kind of labs that we have in Alaska are what police generally call, mom and pop operations. They're small labs. They're set up very quickly. They're fairly transportable. Sometimes they're even found in motor vehicles. And in those kinds of small labs, which in my mind are particularly dangerous because they can be set up so easily and in occupied locations, we're seeing amounts of pseudoephedrine in this range, and the 6 grams of pseudoephedrine comes out to about 5.5 grams of methamphetamine, and as mentioned the other day, about $100 a gram in urban areas, and 2 to 3 times that much in rural areas in Alaska. So even a small amount of pseudoephedrine, even that 6 grams, can result in a typical size cooking operation, which results in a fair amount of profit for the chemist.
Thank you.
Questions, Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, I have a number of concerns too, and I'm generally supportive of the bill. When the bill first came to us, the concept was people are using Sudafed to make methamphetamines, and that seemed wrong to me, and we don't want that to happen. But now this bill includes all these new crimes. There's a manslaughter crime in here. And so I've got some questions. First, let's go to the 6 grams thing. if I buy a package of Sudafed at the store, and I could be wrong, but that's something you take, what, like two tablets four times a day if you're sick. How much am I using each day in terms of grams?
Through the chair, the Representative Guerra, the typical packet of pseudoephedrine cold medication contains roughly 24 to 30 tablets or capsules, each one having roughly 30 milligrams of pseudoephedrine. So let's say 30 times 30, you're looking at 900 milligrams or 0.9 grams. If you follow the instructions, that will last. It should last a matter of several days. In fact, I actually went down a couple of days ago down to the local drugstore to check these and see what was on the packages. And most of them only recommend taking it for 7 days without actually seeing a physician. I mean, if you go that long and have to take that much medication. There are some products that have 24-hour capsules, which obviously you take more on a more in one capsule. But the 24-hour capsules, I noticed, were only coming five to a package. So again, the package was containing roughly on the order of 1 gram. And as I indicated the other day, the study done by a university in Iowa before their pseudoephedrine law went into effect showed that 95% of the people who bought pseudoephedrine products bought one package at a time. Another 4% bought two packages at a time. And I mean, you're out to the 99.9% before you find people buying four or five packages at a time. So I think really the pattern of usage is such to only get one or two packets at a time. Use that for a few days, and then you next time you have a cold, you've got some left over. There certainly would be instances, I suppose, when somebody might very well, buy a year's worth for a family. But I think that what we've got to realize is the police are trying to deal with what they perceive as an epidemic situation. They are not going after the breadwinner of a family of five who's buying, six packages at once. They want to go after the guy on the street who's, looking for a buyer for the six packages that he just ripped off from the local Costco. And that's the kind of situation that they want to deal with. They don't want to, bother somebody who bought it for their family.
Representative Kira. Cut me off when somebody else needs to ask a question.
Pete's about to jump in.
Well, let me ask you this. Does Costco sell Sudafed?
Mr. I've heard that they do. I haven't actually gone.
I looked for it the other day when I was in there, and I did not find it on the shelves.
Before I agreed to 6 grams of Sudafed, I got to make sure that, you're making it a crime to possess that amount, not to have a meth lab, but to possess that amount even if you don't have a meth lab. And I want to make sure that we're not criminalizing conduct that we don't want to throw people in jail for.
What page is that on?
The possession crime is at page 5, line 17.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I know what you're talking about because I've heard communication from Arctic Fire up in Fairbanks, who sends cold medicine in bulk out to man camps. And so I understand precisely the issue you're talking about, which is folks that are conducting commerce, not necessarily reselling it as a retailer out in a man camp that might be set up in a remote site that might have more than 6 grams. So I understand the point that you're getting at, and I'm not sure that it's addressed here that doesn't identify somebody as a felon who's really just trying to ship cold medicine out to, Boy Scout summer camp. Or Girl Scout summer camp, for instance, would probably fall under the concern that you have if somebody were transporting a larger quantity of it. And I don't have a means to address that. I might look to you.
Yeah.
since I would throw out this offer, we want to close down meth labs. We want a bill like this to give us the ability to find meth labs. So the bill helps us find meth labs. It helps us find people who are purchasing a lot of Sudafed to make meth. I don't think we also need to have a crime that is a strict liability crime that says you're a criminal if you don't have a meth lab but you have Sudafed. And I understand that there are going to be lots of people who have Sudafed but no meth lab who have it for bad reasons, but I'm worried that there are going to be lots of people who have Sudafed for good reasons too if they don't have a meth lab. So
big family.
Madam Chair, just to clarify for the committee, the bill does not make simple possession of pseudoephedrine in the place where Representative Gary indicated on page 5 a crime. It makes it a presumption. You would have to be charged with manufacturing methamphetamine in order for this presumption to apply. So there's a presumption that if you've got more than 6 grams of it, in other words, if you've got a typical amount that a typical meth lab would have, that's a presumption that you intend to manufacture. But to prosecute a case like that, there has to be other evidence. There has to be something else involved other than just, you know, you've just bought 6 grams at your local pharmacy. So it's not in any way a strict liability offense. It's not a simple possessory offense, and I think it's trying to reflect the nature of the problem. Possessing small amounts of these kind of drugs lead to meth manufacturing, and we want to get on top of that.
Chair, I can't tell you how much I disagree with that statement. We're talking past each other, and I understand your intention. I understand, Mr. Guarnelli, that you would never prosecute somebody for this, but I also don't want to pass a law that lets somebody else prosecute somebody for possession when they don't intend to use it to run a meth lab. And the provision on page 5 says it's prima facie evidence that if you possess that amount, you're a criminal. Now you have to come in as the defendant who's charged with being a criminal because they possess that amount and prove to a jury that you're not a criminal.
Representative Gere, is there an amount you feel comfortable with? I mean, we understand that one of the difficulties is proof in these cases and trying to track down who these individuals are. And so when you can use a simple over-the-counter cold medicine to make a very harmful, dangerous drug, you can see the problem in proof. So is there an amount that you feel more comfortable with?
Not without shooting for the hip, Madam Chairman. I'm concerned about the possession crime. I think it should be a crime if you're running a meth lab. I don't think it should be a crime if all the evidence they have on you is that you have 6 or 7 grams of Sudafed in your house. I understand the constant urge to make it easier to prove cases, but when you make it easier to prove cases, you make it easier to make mistakes. And if someone were able to come to me and say there's a certain amount of Sudafed that you would possess in your home and that couldn't possibly be innocent, I'd say that's the amount. And I don't know what that amount is, but I've got concerns that 6 grams isn't the amount. Maybe I'm wrong about those concerns.
So, Mr. Guarnelli, you testified earlier, so one cold pack, if you will, one pack of Sudafed, what is it, 0.0-something grams?
One typical pack is about 9/10 of a gram of pure pseudoephedrine.
So how many of these packs equal 6 grams?
It would be 6+ packs would equal 6 grams of pseudoephedrine of the typical package.
California has 9 grams, and there are other states that have.
A number of other states have a 9-gram limit. That's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm intimidated because there's 2, 3, 4 attorneys here, and I'm sitting next to 2, so I feel the least qualified to speak on this. Thank God for Representative Cott, because I'm totally connecting with you right now. In Section 6D, I mean, the way that I read it as a layperson, it says, in a prosecution under A of this section, possession of 6 grams or more listed chemicals, and it lists them, it says, or to deliver to another person who intends to manufacture methamphetamine. I mean, a big home or a Girl Scout camp wouldn't be trying to deliver to another person who intends to manufacture methamphetamine. So I don't find there to be malice in it, nor do I think that reasonable people would prosecute, you know, a reasonable family. But perhaps you're more suspect of the justice system than I am, Representative Guerra.
Chair. Representative Guerra.
I think I have a solution to this. I mean, it's one thing to possess this stuff. It's another thing to possess this stuff and have meth lab equipment in your house, too. I suppose it should be prima facie evidence of the intent to manufacture and distribute if you have the Sudafed and have the meth lab equipment. Maybe that's a solution. And then let me ask you one other question before you go on. One other concern I have is there are a ton of chemicals that are listed in this bill. I don't know what any of them are, and I'm looking at, it's also a crime to have 6 grams of iodine. Is that a lot of iodine? It seems like there are legitimate uses of iodine. Should I have the same concern that, I don't know what iodine is used for, other than it's in salt, but tell me why I shouldn't be concerned about that, too.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, one of the people we had scheduled to testify on Monday works at Fred Meyers. Through their own corporate governance at Fred Meyers, they will allow you to buy 3 boxes of Sudafed, which would be the equivalent to 2.7 grams using Mr. Ganelli's math. And there were 4 people. The person that we had that was willing to testify was going to tell us that there were 4 people in that car that were young people, that each systematically came into Fred Meyers and bought 3 packages, which would be 12 packs were in the car, and clearly there was an intent to, you know, they weren't that sick. So I hate to link it to, you know, crystal meth making equipment in the vehicle. And then secondly, I don't know how to address the iodine because I'm not familiar with the measurement iodine, but I think Jane might be able to speak on that. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Guerra through the chair. This is Jane Pearson again. We did some talking with DPS and the Anchorage Police Department, and iodine is not the stuff your grandmother used to put on your gut. Iodine is a crystal or water purification that's used in really large water purification plants. It's highly toxic. You know, a few grams of the stuff is kill somebody. And what you can do is go to your local water supply store and buy a 5-gallon bucket of this stuff. And then it's being resold. So what we're trying to do is just limit the amount that really people could have in their possession, because it's not something your average, I don't have it, you don't have it, you know, it's not a chemical that, you know, anybody would possess.
It's not the kind of iodine you use for health reasons?
No.
Or making salt?
I think
iodized salt?
I don't think it's, I don't know. I couldn't tell you that.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
But isn't that stuff iodine? I mean, maybe it's not the kind of iodine you're, and I'm just using iodine as an example. There are 30 other chemicals in here. I have no idea what they are. But just on the iodine thing, you were talking about the 5-gallon bucket. What happens if you have it in your house? And then, I mean, isn't that stuff that you treat people with iodine, and isn't that stuff in salt iodine?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, iodine is one of the 3 primary ingredients in making meth, pseudoephedrine or ephedrine being one, iodine being another, some form of phosphorus being the third in the most common methods used. The iodine, as Ms. Pearson said, is it's a toxic chemical. Its legitimate uses, primary legitimate uses, are water treatment and some veterinary applications for sterilization. It can be purchased for water treatment purposes in pound and multiple pound measures. A five pound box of iodine is enough to treat over 1 million gallons of water. So if you've got that, you are, you know, if you buy 5 pounds of iodine, you are you ought to be in the business of treating water, because otherwise it is a very toxic substance to have. It's a 5 pound box goes for about $200 in Anchorage, so that's roughly $3 an ounce, and it sells on the street for $50 an ounce. So again, it's one of the main ingredients that addicts and users are taking, they're buying, they're stealing, however they get a hold of it, and they're trading this toxic material on the street for $50, or perhaps for $50 worth of methamphetamine, and then the cookers are using it to for more ingredients. The 6 gram or 9 gram, some states do 6, some states do 9, is something that is, you know, it comes from other states. You know, we think it's an appropriate limit on the amount of iodine, and this isn't iodine in its liquid form. That the type that you might put on cuts and scratches is a very low percentage, and it's in liquid form. Even the type used for veterinary purposes is, you know, 7 to 8% in liquid form. We're talking about the purified iodine that we believe, if you've got that amount of iodine, we ought to be able to say to a jury that that is prima facie evidence that you were manufacturing. Again, you know, I don't know why the state troopers or any police agency would go after somebody who is in the business of water treatment, or is treating their water, or is buying some cold medication for their family or scout trooper, whatever it is. There's no reason to do that. That's not going to stop the methamphetamine problem. That's not going to get anybody any good press. It's going to get, you know, people bad press. I don't know why anybody would want to do that. And, you know, I've heard for going on to 29 years now that from, you know, this committee and others, and I remember even Representative Gruenberg, when he was chair of this committee, it goes back those days, people saying, well, I trust you, Mr. Guinelli, and I know you wouldn't do that, but other people might. And I've been hearing that for 29 years, and I'm still here, and the people that work for me and that I've trained and supervised are probably more cautious than I would be in a prosecution situation. You know, we're trying to deal with a real-life crisis that is endangering all Alaskans, including children. You know, the headlines in the Anchorage Daily News, you know, I think says it more articulately than I can. So I don't know what I can tell you. I will say we have not heard from, you know, industry representatives, people who manufacture and use iodine and those kinds of things. And I think that perhaps at some point we should. But I think that this is based on laws of other states. As Representative Ramos says, it has been done in good faith. And, you know, I think it's an appropriate line to be drawn. I think we need to draw the line.
Rather than talking about what, you know, and that is an important side of it, about the abuse that of charging people with a crime who are not the envisioned group of folks, but also is the reasons for having it. And I mean, my understanding is it is difficult to always catch people in operation. And so they're moving from place to place, and they're ramping up and getting ready, and we have only so many resources in our state. And so that's one of the reasons I think that you want to have this as a lesser crime as part of it. And then the other thing is, I don't know this, but I suspect that there are groups of people that participate in these things sometimes. So there may be one person that runs it, that's the official manufacturer, if you will, the chemist, but that doesn't take away from the responsibility that these other folks should have. If you're the go-to girl or guy to go buy these, go out and buy these Sudafeds throughout the town, if you will, or to collect these iodines or other sources, that, you know, it's no different than buying guns, bullets for a gun, when you know full well that the person that owns that gun intends to shoot it at at innocent victims. And so I think, you know, that's another part of the public policy that is there. But we did have part of this debate when your bill was up on the isomers and some of those. But the new aspect is the Sudafed packs and so on. But Representative Anderson and then Groenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to confirm what you just stated, which I would hope Representative Guerra understands and has more expertise, actually, than we do as a former public defender, that your surveillance and probable cause would be on potential meth lab users and not the grandmother or the Boy Scout or the PAC. And my guess is there's zero precedent for someone coming into a home and saying, you know, we saw you purchase 9 PACs. And you have no background ever with a meth lab, but you're under arrest because this is prima facie case. You know, hypothetically, because of the bill, ha-ha, we got you. I bet there's not even one case of that. So where is your cautious? And actually, I agree with you. We've got to make sure that you're not going after people or you're establishing something for someone purchasing for commercial purposes. You know, how to what level do we analyze it and tweak it? Like the chair said, would 9 grams be fine or 10 or 11 versus saying, well, let's study it for a month before we bring it back. I almost defer to saying, let's go with this. The odds of someone getting arrested are negligible, if any at all, and say that on record, on TV, on, you know, everything memorialized here. So I just can't imagine as a betting man that would happen. And the needs of the bill passage is so much more outweighing than the minutiae of these smaller amounts. As we run out of time and I have to go and Representative Cadesta goes to workers' comp, I think it's just something to be thought. But it's a good point, Representative Guerra.
Representative Groenberg?
Two questions. And I know that I think that you have some questions here. I'm not going to get into that. But and I know you're concerned about the reasonable demands of business. We don't have any salt manufacturers here, but I grew up in the Bay Area. And Leslie Salt has huge salt flats there. And I don't know if Alaska would ever become the scene of any salt manufacturing. I may be arguing something theoretical, but you might want to take a look, Jane, and see if this is going to have any effect on the salt business. I'm not going to offer it. The other question I would ask Mr. Guanelli, if I may, through the chair. You mentioned that some other states have 9 grams. Do any other states have 6?
Mr. Chair, I believe other states do have 6. I think 6 and 9 grams are kind of the typical amounts.
So you'd say maybe an equal number of states have each?
Sure, that I'd hesitate to say because I haven't done that kind of research.
I'll ask any of you. Do any other states have any other numbers, something either maybe between 6 and 9 or higher or lower?
Jay, Representative Ramos?
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, no, the two numbers that we've heard are 6 and 9, and our intention with this bill and with the prior bill is to give law enforcement a toolbox. The size of the tool that they asked for was 6 grams, so we feel like we are accommodating Department of Public Safety by giving them the right size wrench for the problem that they want to fix. They didn't ask for a 9-gram wrench, they asked for a 6-gram wrench. So we are addressing the toolbox. Thank you.
I was wondering if you would like to say anything else.
Through the chair, this is Jane Pearson. Yes, Representative Groenberg. I did a little research on this, and it's about split between 6 and 9 grams, and I'm perfectly happy. I'll give you a printout when I...
No, I really don't need that.
Yeah.
Okay, further discussion. Let's. We've only got 15 minutes left, so let's direct, if we could, our discussion toward amendments, if there will be any, and constructive work on the bill, if we can. Representative Cutt?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. I have somewhat of the same concern, I think, with Representative Guerra had on the 6 grams. I don't know where the sponsor came up with the original 9 grams, but it just appears to me that if a person purchases 6 grams within a 30-day period, whether or not they are caught or prosecuted, they are a criminal. You don't have to commit a crime and not be prosecuted to be not committing that crime. It just seems like those who may, again, I'm kind of wrestling with, 6 grams, I think looking at the numbers is about seven packages, and I'm trying to, in my mind, figure out who might purchase seven packages of that, which would then put them over the limit and into the criminal element. Again, whether or not you are prosecuted or even if it's detected, you've committed a crime. So I'm wrestling with the amount.
I know a lot of law students that used to buy packs of Sudafed.
I don't know, Madam Chair, if you know, if Costco here doesn't sell it, but it seems like I recall seeing that on the shelves in Anchorage, but I may be wrong. I don't use Sudafed, so I just let it code run its course. But if they sell it in bulk, I don't know what that, if it's six packages or 10 packages or 12 packages to the container at a wholesale facility, if that changes the dynamics. And certainly we haven't heard from any of the retailers or wholesalers or manufacturers and, or the packaging groups. Might put that together. I still had a little bit of a loss here.
Representative Anderson?
Madam Chair, I disagree respectfully with Representative Cott. Section 6, page 5, that D where it states of the amount, 6 grams or more listed, and we've been debating this now, references line 17, in a prosecution under subsection A, which you go back to page 4, subsection A states that basically you're committing a crime if you're manufacturing, delivering, manufacturing, section 2, section 3, possessing, section 4, intent to manufacture, section 5, intent to extract. So that's, I think that's inaccurate to say if you possess, you've violated the law, but if you possess in conjunction, hence the delineation between just possessing and intending to manufacture. I think that's where the law enforcement would have the background data and investigation and surveillance to link the two. But I don't think just owning 6 grams of Sudafren or Sudafed would mean you violated the law.
I'd like to, Madam Chair, to defer that question to Mr. Benelli then. It's, if I purchase 7 grams under this bill, am I a criminal?
Through the chair, there are actually two provisions.
I'm looking in page 8.
One is the provision that Representative Anderson referred to, which creates the presumption from merely possessing it. There is another provision on page 8 that talks about purchasing more than 6 grams within a 30-day period. And so if you purchased 7 packs all at once, I mean, I think as a practical matter, store is not going to sell you that much. I mean, I think that they're going to adopt policies that are not going to sell seven packs all at once. They may very well sell you 6, but as we heard, some are adopting policies to sell even less. And frankly, just as an aside, I mean, I've heard that the drug companies are in the process of developing other types of cold medication products that don't contain pseudoephedrine, and so my guess is that in a couple of years, all of these may be off the shelves anyway, simply because they aren't being produced. But that aside, I mean, we've got this problem now. You know, perhaps, and I don't have anything drafted, but just, you know, listening to the debate and thinking about it, if there is a concern for people who might be, you know, responsible for buying or for providing health care to a larger group of people. I mean, let's say, you know, someone who runs a group home or, you know, a scout camp or something like that. I mean, it would be fairly easy to engraft within the exceptions for someone who is responsible for providing health care to, you know, a group of people under.
And I had a hotel out in the bush or something where you have employees and maybe even guests where you want to keep a stock of.
And I don't know whether they would be considered dispensers or retailers. If they're giving it away, then maybe not. But if they're selling it to their guests, then they probably would be considered a retailer, and then it would be lawful for them to have it as a retailer of that.
Okay. Without further discussion, why don't we get an amendment on the table? I see where people are headed.
Representative
Gruenberg, briefly.
I hadn't thought of this. But I have a condition called rhinitis, and it's a bad sinus condition.
And I used to take a Sudafed, and it helped me go to sleep. And I would take a pill every night. And I'm afraid that with this, a person who would take a Sudafed to help them sleep on a nightly basis would be criminalized under the language on line, page 8, line, whatever, it's 14. That really concerns me.
Madam Chair, just to put this in context, if a 30-capsule pack is 0.9 grams, then to get up to 6 grams, you've got to have 198 capsules or tablets.
Oh, really?
And, that's...
So I wouldn't be a criminal. That's good to know.
That's you know, more than a half a year's worth of nightly dosage.
That makes me feel a lot.
And Madam Chair,
that's
I think
I
that,
to
and I think that Madam Chair, through the
yes,
yeah, no,
well, just through the regulation process, I think that we would let retailers know this. And secondly, you can still get a prescription. Page 8, line 25, that was, you can get a valid prescription if you have to have that many. So I think you'd be covered either way.
But
One thing, though, we talked while you were gone briefly, I noted that I thought this had been adopted, but just to make sure for the record, I move that we adopt for committee discussion purposes by the committee. Now the testimony's done. CS for House Bill 149, version S.
Okay. Any objection to that motion? Just
now
so it's officially
we're getting
before
to
us.
Amendment.
Okay, hearing done. We have version S before us. Amendments from the committee. Representative Guerra.
I'm going to do these. I've got a couple written, but I'm going to do these as most of them conceptually. I'm going to move to strike Section 6 as possession section and ask the sponsor to work on something more narrowly tailored. I'll move. Amendment number one is to strike Section 6, and then I'll explain it.
Okay.
I'll object.
There's an objection for you to explain it.
Yep. I think if you said it's a crime to possess and there was some other additional indication that the person was also distributing or manufacturing meth, that would be okay. But just the simple possession at this point causes me concern. So I'd be very sympathetic to a provision that lets us get at people who possess the stuff and are meth distributors or users or manufacturers. But just the possession concerns me. So, and Representative Anderson, with all due respect, when you said we were wrong, we weren't. You said we're not making just possessing this stuff a crime. We are.
Section 6,
and then you reference back that just possessing is proof of the intent to distribute, the proof of the intent to manufacture. That's true, but all you have to prove is possession. Anyway, until it's more narrowly drafted, and since we don't have the time to draft it better here, I would just move to strike Section 6 for now.
Representative Anderson speaking.
Thanks.
To your objection.
Madam Chair, real quick, I failed to note inadvertently Section 9, and so Representative Guerra is correct in the context of possession is a crime under that section. Again, to reiterate, on page 5, Section 6 states explicitly under subsection D, first of all, to quote, in a prosecution under A. So already you're being prosecuted because, again, going back to page 4, you've manufactured, possessed, had an intent to manufacture, intent to extract. From there comes the possession and the link. And so I disagree with getting rid of Section 6. Section 9 is another story, and I may join in the entertainment of getting rid of that section.
I will make that motion.
But not Section 6. So I maintain my objection.
You've heard the arguments. Any further debate? Okay, Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on Amendment Number 1?
Representative McGuire.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Coghill is not present. Representative Cott.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom is not present. Representative Gruber.
Yes.
Representative Guerra.
Short amendment list.
I know.
You meant Section 9.
Yes.
So, Amendment Number 1 fails to carry. Amendment Number 2, Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, I would that wasn't my favorite way of dealing with this. So let me do another conceptual amendment. At page 5, line 29, I don't think it should be proof of intent to commit some sort of criminal act if you're possessing the stuff for illegal use. So I would insert the words after the words valid prescription, the following words, or possessed for illegal use. And that way, if you possess this stuff for illegal use, it's not a crime. It probably makes this section hard for the prosecution to use, but I think what we're getting at is we don't want to criminalize the behavior of buying Sudafed so people can treat family colds. So.
Does the sponsor of the bill want to comment? Or Mr. Ganelli?
I'd like to defer to, through the chair, I'd like to defer to Mr. Ganelli for interpretation.
Sure, the whole purpose of creating presumptions like this is to recognize that these are substances that have that in generally when possessed in this amount don't have a legal use. I think that if in order to create the presumption we have to prove that they were going to use it illegally, then the presumption essentially disappears. We don't have it anymore. We have to prove our case that they were going to manufacture methamphetamine with it. Well, if we have to prove that, then we don't need the I mean if we can't prove that easily, then we don't need the presumption. I'm not exactly sure where the purpose of the amendment. I mean, in essence, the amendment guts the presumption, and for that reason, from the standpoint of the prosecutor, we would certainly not be in favor of that.
And Madam Chair, just so let's say that they had, thank you, 8 packs, and it's a known meth lab, but they've cleaned out everything, and they have eight packs. They would thank us for supporting this amendment because they would argue, their attorney would argue, wait, I'm possessing it for legal use, I take it for my allergies. And since there's no other equipment or apparent manufacturing purpose here, I'm okay. I think that we'd be treading lightly, whereas no other person normally would purchase that many. I hope not. I mean, I don't know anybody that buys that much at one time.
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, you're dead on. The troopers have told me that the precursor law that Senator Terrio passed last year, if you had possession of 3 or more of these ingredients, that the DA's office has asked them not to prosecute these anymore because I had the Sudafed, I had a cold, I had the acetone because I was spending room upstairs, and I had the Red Devil because I was cleaning my carpets. And the district attorney said that they're unwinnable cases.
Okay. Representative Guerra, and wrap up?
Yeah, I'm going to withdraw that amendment. I think the best that we can do at this point, if we're going to push this bill through, is to at least be more cautious and go with those states that say 9 grams. I'm going to withdraw that amendment. I'm going to offer a conceptual amendment as amendment number 2 that says in section 6 it's a possession crime, but change 6 grams to 9 grams.
Does that be amendment 3?
All heard. That's amendment number 3. Amendment number 2 is withdrawn.
And I'll object. I know it's going to pass, so I don't think you have to worry, okay. But I still think 6.
Madam Secretary, you call the roll on amendment number 3.
Representative McGuire.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Coghill is not present. Representative Cott.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom is not present. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Yes.
4 yes, 1 no.
So Amendment 3 carries. Any further amendments?
And yes.
And this bill does go to Finance afterwards as well. Representative Gruenberg.
I would move to strike Section 9.
I object, and I would love to hear Mr. Gonelli. I know we're running out of time, but
there's
I've been told by your counsel this is the heart of the bill.
Amendment number 4.
Madam Chair, I think that we have certainly heard anecdotal stories about multiple people going into stores buying multiple packs of this material. You know, the whole point of having the businesses keep records, and so the troopers will be able to check on them, is you know, to act as a deterrent to people you know, buying large amounts of methamphetamine within a short period of time. I mean, we're talking about, you know, if we're talking about, as it reads, you know, 6 grams within a 30-day period, that's, you know, that's about 200 pills within a 30-day period. You know, 200 pills every 30 days, that's, you know, one that's basically a $500 in methamphetamine profit. If it's making 5 grams of methamphetamine at, you know, the urban prices of $100 a gram, that's $500 profit for just complying with the law as it's here in Section 9. That's every 30 days. If we can't limit it to that, I think that much of the value of this entire bill goes away.
Representative Anderson.
How about a friendly amendment that we, Representative Grunberg, that we don't strike Section 9, but that we make the bill conforming so that it's 9 grams throughout the bill?
Let's be very specific. Let us say specifically, so I know what we're doing. Perfect. I will accept this.
And now you're talking 300 pills.
We're talking, okay. So this is an amendment not to strike, but on line 14 would become 9 grams. On line 19 would become 9 grams. On line 24 would be 9 grams. We're talking about just this section, right, Tom?
Yeah, but I think we should be conforming throughout. I mean,
is there any other place where we're dealing with
line 9, page 9?
Say again.
Page 9, line 5.
Page 9, line 5. Exactly. Yes, 9. Are we missing anything else?
We'll have legal services make sure it's conforming.
So is your friendly amendment a conceptual one so that legal services could?
I want to be. Are we going to see this bill at all before it leaves?
No,
even informally.
Grunberg,
copy after.
Among the conceptual amendments offered in this committee, this is probably one of the most simple. Anywhere you see 6 grams, you change it to 9.
Let me ask Jane here. Is there any other place that we have to change 6 to 9?
I don't believe so.
Okay, I accept that as a friendly amendment. Ask unanimous consent.
So the friendly amendment has been accepted. That's amendment number 4. Representative Anderson, do you withdraw your objection?
Yes,
amendment. Any further objection to amendment number 4 as amended? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 4 carries. That brings the bill as amended back before us. Is there any further amendments? Representative Guerra.
But Larry, I still wanted 6.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Actually, let me move, are we up to 5?
Yes.
Let me move amendment number 5, which will be a conceptual amendment on Section 9. To address the issue of the hotel or camp or business that purchases this stuff in bulk. Before I move the amendment, Madam Chair, it might read okay as it is right now. Can I ask Mr. Guinelli a couple questions about this?
Yeah.
Mr. Guinelli, can you look at Section 9? It seems there's a whole list of people who are allowed to sell a lot of this stuff, right? Legitimate wholesalers, legitimate retailers. We're saying you can sell a ton of the stuff. It doesn't matter because you have to. I mean, that's what you do as a business. But it doesn't seem like we're protecting businesses that purchase the stuff, the hotel, the camp, the fire crew. Except that if you look at
line 26.
Except if you look at line 26, which I'm wondering if does line 26 mean it's okay if it's in the ordinary course of a legitimate business that's one of the ones that follows, or if it's in the ordinary course of any legitimate business?
To the chair, the former. In other words, it's only legitimate business as a retailer, a wholesaler, or retail drug distributor, or a manufacturer.
Madam Chair?
Representative Ramos?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, in the other 8 months of the year, I am a reseller of Sudafed in a hotel, and we would keep a logbook. We would buy a case of it, and we would be a reseller of of that through our through a gift shop and would conform to the log book requirement that any other retailer would. Thank you.
Yeah, the question though is if you I think the lodge settings, the one I can get my fingers around, you sell somebody $5,000 or $4,000 for a couple weeks out at a lodge, and while they're there, they're your guest, and so they eat and drink and sleep and all that as a part of what they've paid for, and sometimes they have colds and sometimes they have headaches and so on, and so you can envision like going to Costco and getting, that's what we do, a big bulk of stuff, putting it in a plane, and that's what you do for the year, and you've just got it there. So, because on the earlier section, it does say clearly in the ordinary course of a legitimate business, but now you're sort of narrowing it. So I do think that the person who bought it in bulk and didn't make that actual sales transaction would probably fall under this. Is that right? Am I reading that right?
Sure. The definition of, well, it's got definitions of wholesaler and distributor. I'm not certain in that situation what that person would be. I mean, that person would be a holder of the product, the owner of the product, and would give it out to other people. I don't know that specific provision is covered right now. I think it would be fairly easy to draft up another provision that would cover that. But right now, I don't believe that that's covered. I don't think that any of the terms apply to someone who, let's say, owns a lodge and has, you know, 10 grand or wants to buy 10 grams in bulk.
Or a tent camp or something. You know, you just kind of have to think about Alaska and the way we do business, and you know, you want to get the right people in the loop and keep the wrong people out. So, Representative Guerra?
Sure. I think I have the language that'll do this.
Okay.
So, I'd offer, what amendment are we on?
Amendment
five? It's five, but I think you stated it as one thing.
If you
wanted to change that, it would be an amendment.
What did I say Amendment five was? We haven't voted on Amendment 5? Okay, I withdraw Amendment 5, and I'll offer Amendment number 6, which would be at page 9, line 3, insert a new subsection B2E. Right now, B2E is a healthcare professional licensed by the state. The new B2E would be a business or organization for legal use by persons employed by or served by that business.
Would you read that again, please?
Sure. The new B2E would be, quote, let's see, it would be business or organization for legal use by persons employed by or served by that business or organization.
Reaction from the three amigos? Representative Groenberg.
I think I'm going to oppose it because if you're a criminal, let's say you're Joe Meth, you're going to say all my customers are
El Camino.
You could say all my customers are served by me, and you're going to be out of it. I think that's too broad, guys.
It says legal use. I don't think you'd have an easy time saying that.
I have an idea. Just to consider, these guys have got to go work on the workers' comp bill, which needs a lot of work.
No,
so
we can cancel the meeting.
So, would you be willing, Representative Guerra, with the commitment from the sponsor to work on something between now and finance, and maybe Representative Croft and Meyer and some others could help? I don't think we've fleshed it out, but I think you get the point that there's another category in there that we need to think about, including. Okay, so be willing to withdraw Amendment 6.
Yes, Madam Chair. There's two sort of somewhat substantive other issues.
Okay.
I think one of them we might have agreement on. Let me go to that one first. Representative Crawford, Representative Ramirez, and I were trying to address this whole issue, which I think is the heart of the bill, which is this registry that the bill creates. And it says that a business has to keep a log of who buys the stuff, how much they buy, what they buy, so that if law enforcement wants to go in and try and figure out if somebody's buying a ton of Sudafed, they can. And so there's a registry. And the bill provides that. Right now, the bill says that that registry sits at the business unless law enforcement wants it, and then law enforcement can ask for it. So if you're in Anchorage and all of a sudden you want to start doing an investigation, I suppose you can contact all the businesses and say, we need your records. Representative Crawford, on the other extremes, thinks that believes that, and I think I'm stating this fairly, that we should make, periodically, we should make all these businesses just send those records by e-file or something like that into the law enforcement agency. And that way they won't have to do a records request to 300 different businesses every time they want to investigate. I think I'm stating this fairly when I say Representative Ramirez thinks that goes too far. And I think we've come up with what I think is a compromise to say, and this would be a conceptual amendment, that it should be a local option. That if a local government believes that they would like to have this information sent to them, that on a periodic basis, if the local government passes an ordinance asking for this, that that these records should be sent to the local law enforcement agency on a periodic basis. Did I state that fairly?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra has stated this correctly. My concern is to be a burden on small business. Secondly, DPS does not want the records of everybody in Alaska that has caught in the cold in the last 6 months. And thirdly, meth is not a problem, let's say, in the community of Ketchikan, but we all know from the Anchorage Daily News that it's a tremendous problem in the Mat-Su area. So it allows us to localize the where we may want more precise information. So it's seen as a very friendly amendment and an excellent compromise that's been engineered by Representative Guerra between Representative Crawford and myself.
It's so great, and then it allows communities to evaluate their resources as well and to see whether, rather than us passing along another unfunded mandate. So that'd be 7, conceptual amendment 7, Madam Secretary? Okay.
So that would be conceptual amendment number 7.
You want to move it?
I move conceptual amendment number 7.
Any objection to conceptual amendment number 7? Okay, that carries.
Sure, I think we should leave this one for the floor, maybe. We now have the local option. I suppose if a company violates the law, do we have a penalty provision in this bill as it is?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Fine up to 10,000.
Civil fine, 10,000.
I think for the local option thing, I wouldn't want to make that a crime if you forgot to send your stuff in. So the local option is the local government says you have to send it in every 30 days. I don't think I want to make that a misdemeanor if they forget. I think I would maybe do an amendment number 8 that says knowing violation of that's the local option section if the local government buys into it. A knowing violation is punishable by a fine of up to $500 per violation. And then the up to gives the court the discretion whether or not to impose a fine or not.
Okay. Conceptual number 8, you moved it?
9.
8. Conceptual amendment number 8.
Okay. Moved. Any objection? Okay, hearing none. Conceptual amendment number 8 carries. Anything further? Representative Gruenberg.
Go ahead.
Just one last one, and this is huge, I think. I have a problem with Section 1 of the bill, this is where I think I bond both Representative Ramirez and Representative Crawford, because I think both of their bills include this provision. I don't know that I agree that we should create the new manslaughter crime. I think manslaughter is manslaughter. If you if you recklessly cause somebody's death, it's manslaughter. And we just have a general manslaughter law. This bill now says that if you're sort of a mule, you transport some of the stuff from to somebody who's got a meth lab, and then somebody dies. It's a terrible thing, but we make the person who, the delivery person, a murderer, I guess. I don't know that I feel comfortable with that, but that's, I feel comfortable making all of this stuff a crime: possession, distribution, manufacture, the way we've discussed it. Methamphetamines are very dangerous, and all of that should be a crime.
We did debate this thoroughly in another hearing, in a prior hearing, so I don't want to spend a tremendous amount of time on it. I would just, I can't make this request as the chair. I mean, I can't enforce it. There's no way to, but I would request that at least the sponsor be given the courtesy, especially on a light committee day, to allow a very substantive part of his bill to go forward, at least to finance. And as you said earlier, if it's removed on the full floor, it is. You can keep the amendment in and let's vote on it, but that's a pretty big part of the bill. So that being said, is there any debate on amendment? I guess it's number 9.
Let me modify the amendment.
Representative Kerr?
What number was that?
9.
I'm going to withdraw amendment 9 and make this amendment number 10, I think.
Okay.
It would be to change Section 1. Here's the heart of my concern. I think if you manufacture the stuff, you're much more culpable than the kid you hire to buy the Sudafed and bring it to you. I think if you knowingly manufacture and it causes a death, then maybe manslaughter is appropriate. But if you, so I would, amendment number 10 would be to delete on page 2, line 1, the words "or delivers."
Mr. Benelli?
I'll object for discussion purposes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a provision from the governor's bill, and it's one that I know the administration feels strongly about because as Representative Guerra indicates, manufacturing any of these drugs is serious, and I think that you certainly run the risk that somebody is going to die by what you have made. But I think that people who actually sell, and when we're talking about delivering, I mean it means selling. I mean you're a seller, you're a crack dealer, you're a heroin dealer, you're actually selling the stuff on the street. And we are not talking about the ingredients that go into making it. We're talking about a controlled substance, and the pseudoephedrine itself right now is not on our controlled substance list. It's not in one of the schedules, that, you know, Schedule 1 being the opium products and Schedule 2 being the finished methamphetamine, etc. It's not within that. We're talking about heroin, we're talking about cocaine, we're talking about methamphetamine. If you're out there selling this stuff, if you're out there making it, and someone dies as a direct result, I mean, you know, we're talking about overdoses, we're talking about, you know, people who inject other people with these drugs. It's a situation that in other states is treated as murder. I mean, there are some states, particularly on the East Coast, that have large heroin problems that make this kind of crime murder in the first degree. Other states make it second degree murder. We thought that it was a fairly measured response to make it manslaughter. And so that was the purpose of it. We think it's important. And anyway.
Madam Chair, I'll maintain my objection and note that it's 3:20 and we have a completely full hearing room in Labor and Commerce because of the workers' comp. It's fair for your amendment, but I object. Can we have a vote?
Madam Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment now. We'll talk about it later. Given the choice between a rushed decision or
Madam Chair,
withdrawing it, I'll
I have waited it. Very patiently.
Representative Green.
I have one amendment.
Sure.
And this is something I've talked with several of you about. The governor's bill on page 3, line 7, makes this type of child endangerment a Class C felony. And I do support that. I think this is a terrible thing that they're doing. But I would, the governor's bill was done with a great deal of thought. Wasn't an emotional response, and I'm very respectful to the maker of this. I would move to change Class B felony to Class C felony.
I'll object to hear Representative Ramros speak on the subject.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will defer to Dean Grinnelli's expertise. His point of view is that it is more appropriate to be a C, and respect Representative Gruenberg on that point. I maintain my emotional objection to it, respectfully.
Do you disagree?
I agree and disagree. I'm with you.
Madam Chair?
Representative Garrett?
Just as this goes on, you know, I mean, we spend all our time talking about B's and C's. I don't know what the difference in the sentence is between a B and a C and why a B, right, sitting right here.
Up to 5 for a C, up to 10 for a B, and up to 20 for an A. And
what's the presumptive?
And there isn't a presumptive.
Madam Chair, for under the new bill that just passed, the presumptive range for a C felony is 0 to 2 years. And under a B felony for the first offense, it is 1 to 3 years. But under both of those first offense, you can get an SIS under amendments made to the.
What's the crime that we're making it from a B to a, that was a C, then an A, then a B, and now a B?
It's the, yeah, it's at the top of page 3.
Child endangerment.
There's a fine that's commensurate with it, and I think it's like $25,000 for A, $50,000 or $100,000 for B, and $500,000 for A. I think it's up to $500,000 for A, up to $100,000 for B, and up to $50,000 for
A, $100,000 B, $50,000.
Most of the defendants can't afford any of that, so that's
kind of a moot issue.
On the record.
Keep that in the back of my mind.
Okay, Representative Anderson, do you maintain your objection? To amendment number 11. Okay. Any further objection, Representative Guerra?
That passed, right?
Not unless you.
No objection.
No objection. Okay. And so, is that amendment 11? Amendment number 11 carries.
And Madam Chair, just really briefly, I didn't mean to make you feel bad on that rushing your amendment. I just agree with Mr. Grinnelli. So all I was saying was let's have a vote. Unless someone else had a comment, you could have maintained that amendment.
Representative
I don't
Guerra.
Know if it would have passed or not.
Yeah, the only other concern, I mean, we can pass the bill out. The one remaining concern I have about this bill is there's this huge list of chemicals, and I don't think any of us know what they are, right? I just picked the one that I had heard of before, which was iodine, right? But I don't know what any of these other ones are, and I think we need to have somebody with some.
They're anabolic steroids.
Testosterone.
What's that?
We rolled the anabolic
testosterone.
Testosterone. Come on, Les. You heard of testosterone, right?
through the chair.
Representative Ramros?
Through the chair. Representative Garrett, that is a list that was given to us as an amendment from Representative Croft.
So the whole 6-gram thing now applies to the steroids, or that's not the 6-gram thing?
You are correct. It is not the 6-gram thing. It is just the list of steroids as was presented by Representative Croft.
Okay, so. Great.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, that would change it to a six.
Yep. Okay. And so I guess just the remaining question is at least iodine. I think somebody needs to have a discussion before this bill gets passed, whether it's okay to. I mean, I don't think we completed this discussion on whether it's okay to have 6 grams of iodine.
It's on to House Finance, and I think you know there's been good discussion here that you could follow up with the bill sponsor and. Get some of those answers. Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move CS for House Bill 149 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations as amended.
Is there an objection to moving the bill out of this committee? Okay, hearing none. At last, amended House Bill 149 has been moved.
Catch a plane.
Thank you, Representative Carter. So we are adjourned.